Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls because we have with us on the line Mr. David Maquette, and he's with the airline pilots, a group that really deals with trying to get the pilots armed. What's the official name of your organization?
I'm with the Airline Pilot Security Alliance.
All right, the Airline Pilot Security Alliance. And certainly, I think everyone realizes that since 9/11, it would certainly be nice to know that we had up there in the cockpit pilots and co-pilots who were armed to protect the cockpit in case there were terrorists on board the plane. And this would seem to be a logical situation. Even Barbara Boxer, the senator from the state of California, who's violently anti-gun on most issues, has supported this legislation, as have the majority of the senators and the majority of the members of the House of Representatives. But for some strange reason why this has not come to pass. The legislation was passed by both the House and Senate, signed by the President. Why don't you tell our listeners, David, what's really happened as far as the legislation is concerned once it was passed?
Well, the first legislation that was passed was called the Aviation and Transportation Security Act, and that authorized the TSA to arm airline pilots, but the TSA flat refused to do so. It took a second piece of legislation, which we authored a year later, which was presented to compel the TSA to do that. And in the words of the TSA's attorney, and this is in congressional testimony, they simply said, well, fine, okay, we're told we have to do it. We'll just make it so difficult that no pilot in his right mind will volunteer. And that's exactly what they did. They used their discretion, authorized them under the law to use psychiatric checks and background checks and things like that to reject hundreds of applicants. They've rejected former police officers, firearms instructors, military pilots that are authorized to carry nuclear weapons, as well as pistols, have been told by the TSA they are not psychologically competent to carry a pistol in their cockpit.
Well, now, why would they do something like that? Certainly, isn't the bureaucracy, isn't the government subservient to our duly elected representatives? And if overwhelmingly our duly elected representatives want this to happen, where does the bureaucracy get off saying, we're not going to do it?
Well, we don't know. There was some discretion under the law because I think the Congress believed that the TSA would implement the law in good faith, and they obviously didn't. Whether the TSA is worried that someone will say, you know, we don't need air marshals because now we have armed pilots or federal flight deck officers, we don't know. We would argue that you need both layers of security. You need as many layers of security as you can, and yet they haven't. Actually, in April, the director of the Federal Air Marshal Service, Thomas Quinn, wrote a memo critical of the newest version of this legislation, which tells them how they're going to have to implement this program. And he said that he was not in favor of it, and he called for a lobbying effort against it, because, in his words, pilots were not trained to execute search warrants, they weren't being trained to interview suspects, and they weren't being trained to testify in court. So this is the kind of bias we're facing now in the Transportation Security Administration.
But, of course, isn't this man who's in charge of the air marshals, isn't he a government employee? Isn't he part of the bureaucracy that seems so intent upon leaving our airline passengers unguarded and unprotected?
He's a career employee of the Federal Air Marshal Service. And, you know, to their credit, there are people in the aviation operations section and other areas of the TSA that really want to see this law enacted or implemented properly because they know how defenseless we are up there. But it's some of the bureaucrats in the higher positions which just, they've acted against it.
Well, I think that one of the significant things is this rule about having the pistol in a box, and it has to be locked in that box at all times when the door is open. So the only time you can have the pistol is when the door is locked, but if the pilot has to get up and go to the bathroom for some reason, then he has to lock his pistol away, and yet that's the most vulnerable time, isn't it?
It is, and when the cockpit door is opened, not only is that very onerous for the pilot, we've estimated that pilots are boxing and unboxing their guns 160 to 170 times a month. But beyond that, of course, there's huge safety and security implications, because every time you move the gun, the rate of accidents goes up a little bit. And so we have a lot of volunteers that won't come near this program because they don't want to carry a third bag. They don't want to carry a steel box around with a gun in it. No other agency in the country uses lockbox for exactly these reasons, for safety and security reasons. And yet the TSA says for some reason it's critical in this instance, and they haven't been able to explain to us why.
Well, would it appear to you that the fact that the people in the bureaucracy don't want the passengers on the plane protected? I mean, is there any other logical explanation? Because if you look at things logically, you would think that everybody would want to have the people on those planes protected, and certainly the last line of defense is the cockpit.
Well, that's what we've been arguing, and that's what an overwhelming bipartisan majority of Congress found also. It's just a few people in the administration and in positions of authority in the TSA that have said flat out, no, we're not going to implement this, and we're going to try to find any obstruction we can to keep it from happening. And they have. One of the things they've done, for example, is they've refused to issue federal flight deck officers badges. Even dog catchers get badges. And we've said we need badges for federal flight deck officers in case the FBI ever has to do a tactical entry to an aircraft that's been hijacked. It's basically so we don't have friendly fire instances, so that if an individual has a gun out defending the airplane, a federal flight deck officer, he also has a badge hanging around his neck to protect him from being shot by the FBI. And we've also said, if God forbid a pilot is stopped on the way to work trying to make it to work on time for speeding, the police officer that stops him and asks him if he has any weapons in the car has to have a standard credential given to him to say, yes, this person's a federal officer. And yet, when we told the TSA these are the reasons we need badges, the TSA responded by saying, no, we're afraid you'll use them to get out of traffic tickets. I mean, that's what they have. That's the best they can do. And it just doesn't stand up to reason at all.
Do you ever have a feeling that we live in a world gone mad and there are only a few of us who are still sane?
There's a lot of people that don't understand why this is going on, and there's a lot of innocent Americans who are going to pay the ultimate price, because while the military is spending millions of dollars training their pilots to shoot down innocent airliners, the government is refusing to give the military pilot's colleague or counterpart in the airliner just a pistol to keep the shoot down from becoming necessary. It does seem pretty ludicrous when you think about it.
Well, one of the things that we had mentioned before when we talked was that apparently in the past there were certain pilots at least had the authorization to carry weapons, and that authorization was withdrawn 2 months approximately, or 2 or 3 months before the 9/11 attack. What was the background of that authorization? Because certainly the majority of pilots were not carrying weapons. I don't know if any of them were carrying weapons, but didn't some of them have the right to carry weapons?
At the time, if the airline approved, a pilot could carry a weapon with him, and some pilots did it sort of under the wire where they didn't talk and the airline didn't talk, but it was permitted. And then 2 months before 9/11, they just redacted that regulation, which was followed by this September 11th. You know, it's interesting, Victor Saracini, who's one of the heroic flight crew members who was killed on 9/11, was one of the most outspoken opponents of arming pilots before anybody else realized the need, and he recognized how defenseless these airplanes were. And he was tragically killed on that day. And that's one of the things we've always wondered. If Captain Saracini had a weapon with which to protect himself, would that crash have gone completely differently? Would he have been able to save his passengers? And that's basically all we're asking for the right to do is save our passengers. We don't want to patrol airports And we don't want to write tickets. We just want to be able to keep our pastors from being killed.
And the last thing you want to do is be able to serve a search warrant or to, you know, the explanations really are so superficial. Now, wouldn't it be possible for the president simply with an executive order to circumvent all the bureaucracy and just say this is what's going to happen? It would happen?
Oh, tonight, in 30 seconds, with the stroke of a pen, President Bush could implement the provisions of the new legislation which compels the TSA to run this program properly. It's called the Cockpit Security Act. That hasn't happened yet. And what's kind of scary is that we're living in an environment now where we have pretty strong evidence that terrorists are conducting organized probes of our airliners. And I don't know if your listeners are familiar with Northwest 327, but this is an incident that happened about 3 weeks ago. On June 29th, I think it was, where several passengers reported they were afraid they were going to die on that flight because they had Middle Eastern males walking up and down the aisles, going back and forth to the lavatory for no apparent reason, taking things in and out with them in a group in a manner that suggested that there might be an action taken on board that airplane, and yet most airplanes are defenseless in the sky. The vast majority.
Well, now, that is a very interesting incident, as I remember, because certainly the stewardesses were frightened. They were taking packages into the bathroom and then not bringing them out and really almost appearing very menacing. And then, of course, when the plane landed, they were surrounded by FBI agents. The people were taken in question and then all let go. What was this really all about?
Well, they were let go because they were legitimate musicians. There's no question they were legitimate musicians who had a legitimate performance to play at their destination. It came out after they were released that the vast majority of them, I think it's all but one, were traveling on expired visas. And right now the Judiciary Committee of the Senate, and I believe also the House, is investigating the FBI's handling of this incident. Because they're wondering why musicians, they're Syrian musicians. Why are Syrian musicians from a country that is on a list that supports terrorism, traveling throughout the United States freely on expired visas? Another fact that was reported, and we haven't confirmed it, is that these musicians write songs, or the band they support, write songs glorifying suicide bombers. So I guess our point is that the simple fact that a person has a legitimate job, whether it be as a ramp agent or a musician, does not mean or not mean that they are not supporting or gathering terrorist intelligence. I think that's what we need to be careful of.
But even more than that, if they're here illegally, you would think that they would be deported immediately, arrested and deported.
At the very least, they should have been taken aside and interrogated strongly. It gives you the authority to interrogate them for having an expired visa, and we could have found out what they're all about instead of just letting them go and play their gig.
No, but it seems to me like they were playing games with the minds of the people on board that plane.
I don't know. We've had too many instances, and we have a security alert on our site about this. We've had too many instances that mirror that one to suggest that they're all innocent. And while I would say that there have been a number of instances that have unfairly targeted innocent Middle Eastern people, good Middle Eastern folks of this country and other countries, there are too many that are so similar and where the degree of behavior is so extreme that you can't write it off that easily, that you really need to look further into it. We've had individual air marshals and the Federal Air Marshals Association tell us that terrorists are conducting organized probes of our airliners in anticipation of new attacks. Now, the Federal Air Marshals Service, the government, says, oh, no, that's not going on. We don't have any specific intelligence of that. But you have to be careful with the word specific intelligence, because that may mean we don't know the terrorist names. They said they had no specific intelligence of September 11th right before it happened. So you kind of have to weigh that in also.
Well, now, of course, one of the things is that we're supposed to have air marshals. The air marshals are the first tier of defense to protect the cockpit. Do we have any idea what percentage of our planes really have air marshals on them? Is this 100%? Is this 80%? Is this 90%?
No. Wishful thinking. That's in fantasy land.
I realize.
Number of federal air marshals, they say the TSA likes to say, or the Federal Air Marshal Service likes to say, we have thousands of air marshals protecting our skies. In reality, they have a few thousand, but when you put them into teams, which, you know, divide by at least two, and maybe they work in larger teams, and then you consider the fact that there are 35,000 flights a day in the United States, the number of flights that are protected are just the smallest fraction of flights. And yet we're spending $618 million on that protection next year. We could arm 40,000 airline pilots for 1/6 of that and would only have to spend it one time. And then the recurrent number, a couple million dollars a year to continue to run the program, would protect the vast majority of our flights in the sky. And you've got to remember that these pilots are people that, you know, could tomorrow quit being a pilot and volunteer and become a federal air marshal, almost across the board. They're all college educated, very trainable, very mature. And it's a shame not to use that resource. Well, and they want to do it for free. They don't even want any salary for it.
Well, now, one of the things that intrigues me is this idea that, you know, you can sort of tell who the air marshals are. They all have to wear a suit and a tie and a white shirt and polished shoes, and that you can almost walk down through the first class section of the plane and say, hey, there's an air marshal. And instead of course, having them try to blend in with the rest of the passengers, why, because of their dress, it's very obvious who they are. Is that a legitimate criticism?
It is, and I won't comment on exactly what the dress code is, but I'll say that it's not unfair to say they're dressed right out of Men in Black. And the point we've made is that the September 11th terrorists spent months trying to blend in to our society. They didn't show up on 9/11 in long beards and robes or any of the stereotypical things that Americans think terrorists look like. They look like us. So if Osama bin Laden understands the need to have his terrorists blend in, why doesn't Thomas Quinn, the director of the Federal Air Marshal Service, understand the same thing? And this is something the Federal Air Marshals have been complaining about across the board, that it illuminates the pastures, it illuminates the terrorists. If a terrorist is standing in a gate area and observes two air marshals, they can simply go to another flight, and they're not hard to find, that is not defended by Federal Air Marshals. And they won't have armed pilots on board either.
All right, and of course, the thing that is really so disturbing is, as they've made it so difficult for the pilots, those pilots who were determined to go ahead and get the right to carry a weapon. My understanding is that they put the school in a very, first of all, the pilot has to take off for a week on his own and pay for his without pay. Is that right?
That's right. And you know, it's funny that there are so many pilots that don't even care about that. They're willing to volunteer the time. They're willing to take a loss to do this, and they go to a remote facility in Artesia, New Mexico, and it's a good facility, but it's very difficult to get to, and we need more of them across the country.
But why would they put it in such an obscure area? Why not have it in an area that would be convenient for the pilots? I understand that you have to fly there, and then you have to rent a car, and you know, they make it just as difficult as possible for the pilot to get there, and then they give him psychological tests, which could actually, if he took that psychological test and he got a psychiatrist, is as crazy as most of them are, and I know because I've worked with psychiatrists as a physician, I've worked with them, and an awful lot of them are crazy as a hoot owl, they could actually destroy that pilot's career.
Well, they haven't done that yet. There is a big boldface on the application that says that the TSA can share any of its subjective judgments of a pilot's competence with its employer and the FAA. So many, many pilots feel that they're playing I bet my job just by applying to this program. And they aren't going to jump through these hoops. If they get through the psychiatric interview, then they go to this remote facility and they train for a week. And the training is very good if you can get there, but there's not enough of it. Artesia is being used, and the facility used to be in Glencoe, Georgia, which was much more convenient. It was outside Atlanta. But they've moved it to Artesia because this program is being put on the back burner. It's getting short shrift. And we have so many tens of thousands of pilots that were originally interested in this, and now virtually all of them, 95% of them, have changed their minds.
But don't
so
you think
the end result... Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, isn't that exactly what the government wants? And when I say the government, I'm talking about the bureaucrats who are blocking the arming of the pilots.
Well, we think originally that's exactly what they wanted, and they got it. We have a program that is a shell of the program that Congress originally wanted, that Congress originally said we have got to have. We walked the hill with Congress, or to Congress, and talked to everybody and told them about concealable weapons. The FBI publishes a catalog of concealable weapons and plexiglass knives and things that cannot be detected. We said, you're trusting a security system that last year let a Maryland college student get weapons on the airplanes 100% of the times he tried, and you're trusting it, and we don't have any defense on board the airliners. And Congress said, yes, we've got to pass a law, and they did, and this is this is the result of it, is the shell of a program that should be much more than it is.
And I think what one of the lessons is that the Congress, members of the House and Senate, many of them, I'm sure, dedicated public servants, they really don't have much to say about it. They can pass all the laws they want to, but the bureaucracy runs the government. And, of course, the president has the obligation to make sure it works. He's the executive. And for one reason or another, he will not use the sweep of a pen to protect the American people. We'll talk more about that in just a moment when we get back. And I think everybody should encourage the president to do what needs to do to protect the American people. Well, Dr. Stan, back here, our guest is David McKevin. What really needs to be done? Should people be writing to the president or calling the president or emailing the president? Or do you have some legislation now which will solve the problems and get around this organized, orchestrated effort to leave our passengers, leave the American public unprotected on our airlines?
We do. We authored concert with Senators Bunning and Boxer and Congressman Wilson. We authored a bill called the Cockpit Security Technical Corrections and Improvements Act. That's a big, long word. Basically, it's the Cockpit Security Act. It's in Congress right now. It needs to be brought to the floor. Right now, it's being looked at by the Senate Commerce Committee and the House Aviation Subcommittee. And if we can get it to the floor, folks can contact the congressmen and senators and say, bring this to the floor, force it to be brought to the floor. We can fix this program. It was developed in concert with law enforcement experts. And it does nothing more than order the TSA to run this program in good faith the way other law enforcement programs are run.
But will they do it? I mean, so far they've simply defied the law of the land. They've said, we don't care what the Congress wants. We don't care what the Senate wants. We're going to run this thing, and we're not going to allow the passengers to be protected. Now, if you do pass another law, what guarantee is there that they will abide by that law?
The difference in this law is twofold. The first is that it mandates exactly how long the TSA has to get pilots to training. They have 90 days. It says exactly how pilots will be able to transport their weapons. It mandates credentials for FFDO, standard credentials, and it protects international routes. Right now, only domestic flights are protected by federal flight deck officers because the agreements, at least according to the Airline Pilots Association, the agreements that need to be negotiated for them to carry weapons into foreign countries have not been negotiated. So this bill addresses all of those things. But the second thing it does is it mandates actionability. You can sue. If the pilot can sue if he is disenfranchised by the TSA or rejected by the TSA or the law is not properly implemented by the TSA. So there's a penalty for the TSA not complying with this law.
Well, now, who would you be suing? Would you sue the government because the government is blocking you? Would you sue the bureaucracy? Would you just sue the Department
exactly.
of Transportation? Could you sue the individual bureaucrat who made the decision? Because that's where the rubber meets the road.
Well, most bureaucrats are protected from liability for their actions. However, you would sue the federal government, and then a judge would compel the government to act in good faith and could establish fines or whatever is appropriate if they did not do that.
Well, you know, one of the things that really disturbs me, David, is if we were to have another terrorist attack and the death of 200 or 300 people just on one plane, or 1,000 people on 3 or 4 planes, why this would cripple the airline industry. I mean, last time, some of the airlines have never recovered from 9/11. Why in heaven's name don't the airlines do everything they can to, demand that this legislation be passed to protect themselves financially?
Well, in fact, the airlines have been some of our staunchest opponents. They say they don't want guns on board their airplanes, even though guns are carried thousands of times a year on the airplanes by off-duty deputy sheriffs. So you can have a deputy from rural Georgia carrying a concealed weapon. One of our flights had the New York taxi or the Nevada taxi cab inspector on 6 months or 8 months ago. He's carrying a loaded concealed weapon on his person, and yet the pilot charged with and trained to defend the airliner has to put his in a box at times, and that makes no sense. So it's really kind of convoluted for the airlines to take government bailout money at the same time they oppose legislation which would protect their airlines.
Hold that thought right there for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this evening is David McKevin. He's with this organization that's trying to protect the pilots, to protect the airlines, to protect the cockpit, so that certainly the passengers will be protected. And we were talking about, really, what about the airlines? Aren't they backing the pilots' effort to be armed? And apparently many of the leaders of the airline industry oppose the pilots being armed. They say they don't want people with armed weapons on their planes. And yet, of course, if you are an off-duty police officer, or what was this, somebody who inspected taxi cabs in New York?
The Nevada taxi cab inspector. Right. He's kind of become famous. But the National Zoo's police department can carry, the National Zoo can carry weapons on the airplanes, and the pilots trained to defend them have to put theirs in boxes.
Well, now, of course, the thing that we always hear, but my goodness, you know, if one of those weapons went off, and of course the bullet pierced the shell of the plane, why, of course, we have this idea that suddenly everything's going to decompress, people are going to be having the oxygen masks falling down, and of course the pilot plane's going to have to go into a steep dive simply because a bullet went through the shell of the plane. What's the truth? What is the real danger of having a gun go off inside the cockpit or inside the plane itself?
The true danger is a loud whistling sound. that's actually what happens. We've had airplanes that have had guns in them go off before. We've had military airplanes that have been shot full of holes before. And there's no problem or any catastrophic thing that happens to the airplane. And Boeing has said that. Boeing tests these airplanes with windows removed, and they fly just fine. All the systems are redundant times three. So there's no danger of catastrophic decompression or anything that comes out of the Hollywood movies. But more important, what we've told people is, at the moment, an armed pilot or a federal flight deck officer, or a federal air marshal for that matter, might use his weapon. You are facing certain death anyway if you're on the airliner, and the outcome is only possibly better than it would have been, because if a terrorist gets in the cockpit, and this was proved in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, the airplane crashes, and there is no other outcome. So when the TSA responds by saying, well, we think pilots need to be concentrating on landing the airplane, we absolutely agree. That's just tough sledding when your throat's being slit. So if they give us fire extinguishers and training to fight fires, we're saying, how can you possibly argue that you don't give us pistols and training to fight terrorists?
And, of course, really, most of the pilots, anyway, have been in the military, and they're acquainted with firearms, and most pilots, or the majority of them, are certainly capable of carrying a weapon, even without all the redundance of the psychological tests and the training and all of these other things they're giving them.
Well, the background screening that pilots go through already is so much greater than federal air marshals go through or anybody else. Layers and layers of check rides and a psychological check and a criminal background check, domestic violence screen. I personally have been fingerprinted twice since September 11th, and I don't even know why. So they're some of the most well-screened people in the world. I have a cockpit voice recorder that records every word I say, a flight data recorder that records every movement I make with the controls. I'm watched on the radar screen. I have a partner beside me who watches everything I do. So there's very few professions that are as clean statistically and also as well screened as airline pilots.
So as far as this training, it's very nice, and you might learn a little something about hand-to-hand combat, but, the biggest thing would be to have a pistol, and I don't think that an awful lot of the hijackers would want to attack the cockpit if they knew that the pilot there had a weapon to counter him.
I know I sure wouldn't. There's a certain value that the cockpit door is such a choke point that having two armed pilots or a team of armed pilots behind it would certainly give me pause if I were a terrorist, and certainly ought to give any other terrorist pause. But if they aren't deterred, then at least it is a viable defense, because there is no other viable defense on board an airliner. They made certain mistakes on September 11th, and I won't say what they were, but we don't think they're going to make them again involving their the way they treated the passengers and the way they took over the airplane. And I think that the next time they won't make those mistakes. So I think you need at least some defense on board the airliner. And frankly, to put two air marshals on every airplane is going to take a force the size of the United States Marine Corps. It's going to cost $11 to $15 billion a year. It's not going to happen. So we're saying that here's a free resource of some of the most highly trained individuals in society. They're going to keep the weapon behind the closed cockpit door where it's safe. How can you do better than that?
Well, I don't know how you can do better. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question, our guest this evening is certainly right up on the front lines of this battle to try to have the pilot's arms to protect the American people. And when you hear this discussion, and this is the second time we've had an opportunity to interview David, I mean, you almost want to just want to go outside and just scream because it's so illogical. But then there's so much that's illogical that's going on in our country today. If you have a question or comment, wire telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is David McCatt, and he's with a group that is intent upon protecting the airline pilots and certainly protecting the passengers by having armed pilots in the cockpit. Now, do you have a website? Is there any way people can get in touch with your organization?
We do. We're a large organization. We have 35,000 members, the vast majority of airline pilots from all different airlines, and we're located at secure-skies.org.
Secure-skies.org.
And that's the Airline Pilot Security Alliance. We're pretty much the premier group on this issue. We're a single issue organization determined to bring about real security. We've spent $12 billion on airline security and none of it's working. So we're saying that the airline pilots are at the front. There's an old joke that says the airline pilot is the first one at the scene of the accident. So we're trying to keep that from being true even one more time, at least as regards terrorism.
Well, this is a little off the subject, but one of the things that we know that, for instance, the Israeli airlines, they all have some decoys or various things on there that would protect them from surface-to-air missiles. And if the terrorists were really intent upon taking out some of our planes, they could use surface-to-air missiles, and there's really no defense against them. But why is there all the delay? We're almost 3 years now since 9/11. Why is there so much delay in putting the same sort of decoys onto our planes that the military has on their planes, the Israelis have on their planes?
Well, one of the great things that just happened was that Congressman Micah and some of our staunch supporters that have really provided a lot of leadership on airline security issues, like Alaskan Senator Don Young, have just passed a bill that for what's called MANPADS, which is a missile defense system for civilian airliners. I think that for a long time it was a question of priority. Where do you spend the money? What research do you need to do before you figure out which system works for civilian airliners? But they have done that now. So we will be seeing a civilian airliner defense to missiles in the future.
All right, fine. Well, we've got Paul calling from Capitola. Hi, Paul. Did you have a question or comment for our guest?
It's kind of a question and comment. And I mean, it may sound incomplete or not clear, but I listened to an interview with a German technology minister. He was also defense minister of Germany, and when they bought their airplanes from Boeing, they had a remote control system involved where if the plane were hijacked, the plane could be taken over and landed, and they've tested this in the early 90s flying from here to Australia.
Fine, hold that thought, because we're going to pick up our stations again. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is David McCatt from the Airline Pilots Security Organization. And, of course, we have Paul calling in from Capitola, and he's commenting that he's heard from somebody, apparently a German transportation officer, that there actually is some sort of a mechanism by which if a plane is hijacked, why it can be taken over from the ground, and they can fly it. Is there any truth to that, Paul? Pardon me, David?
I've never heard of that system. I think it would be... I know I don't have it on my airplane. And I know that the amount of money that you would have to spend to get that... We have a fleet of 6,000 commercial airliners in the United States. And to put that system on board every airplane would just be so fantastically expensive. And you would have to have a way to defeat it, because at the end of the day, the pilot wants to be able to go full manual if the computer started acting up and be able to fly his own airplane. So I don't know that it exists, and if it does, it's certainly not here. I give an example. We have a system called a Category 3 landing system, which lets you land in very, very low weather, and it's $50,000 per airplane just to let the pilot land in low weather. To use a remote control system, I can't imagine how expensive that would be.
Well, we can remote control drones and land them and take them off. And I know the planes that were involved in 911 all had this remote system. The new Boeings had it. And I was just wondering why they didn't use it that day. In Flight 93...
Well, you say you know the planes had it, but, of course, David is actually a flyer, and he says he's never heard of it. So, I don't know that we could say that we know that it... I think it's an interesting thing, and I've heard these same things, but can you document that?
He's the equivalent of Donald Rumsfeld in Germany. He worked for 25 years.
Right. Could you get me the documentation and send it to me? I'd sure like to see it.
Certainly will.
Okay, fine.
Okay, take care, you guys.
Thanks very much.
Good work.
Okay, fine. Let's go.
The system that we use on drones, and Paul's right, the system that we use on drones is a completely remote control system. They're designed to not have a human flyer, and that's why they're built that way. I think I'm pretty safe in saying that the airliners that were involved in the hijack on September 11th had no such remote control system. And I don't know that how you would control them from the ground or how that signal would be relayed to the airliner. Now, there is a difference between, some people say fly-by-wire is a remote control system, and what that means is that instead of a cable connecting the cockpit to the wing surface to move the airplane, there is an electronic signal. Now, that's true. But that electronic signal only exists between the cockpit and the wing, not between the ground and the airplane.
I
guarantee that if there was any way to control those commercial airliners on September 11th, we wouldn't let it hit a building.
All right, let's go to Bill, who's calling in from Florida. Hi, Bill. Did you have a question?
Yeah, Dr. Stan. I wanted to ask your guest what he thought or what y'all thought about, you're talking about police officers, you know, being able to carry. What about... all these thousands of citizens around the United States that have concealed carry weapons licenses, to allow them to carry, and you would have even more armed persons. They have to go through a background check, fingerprint, and all that stuff to get a
all
license.
Right. Do you have any thoughts on that, David?
I think you're right, and I'm certainly in favor of civilian concealed carry. I think you have a couple things that are in place on airliners that are not in place in the normal public, and the first is that you have so many people crowded in such a tight space that if a catastrophe happened, you had people running around screaming. We have not even said in this bill that the pilots ought to be going back because the level of training required to pick out the passenger in 9B from the passenger in 9A is greater than not only a civilian would probably have, it's greater than an average police officer would have. So what we've said is that basically the level of training needed to operate in the cabin is probably not something that we would want anybody but federal air marshals to be doing. The second thing that happens is you beat people up pretty bad in the commercial airliners these days. They sit around the airport and you wait for a four-hour flight delay and then you get on, maybe not in the best spirits, and then you're in a pressurized cabin where even the first drink is kind of like three because of the thin air. So we don't want the solution to be worse than the problem. And when you have 35,000 flights a day, I think you might have a problem with that, though I think the vast majority of concealed weapon holders are some of the most, responsible people we have in the country.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay, fine. Thanks very much, Bill. And our telephone number again is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. Well, this bill, this legislation we're talking about, that now is in the, apparently it's in the committee, that's the Cockpit Security Act. Now, do you want our listeners to call in? Is there any House number or Senate bill that they could call or email or write about it? And are you getting any help from our good friend Larry Pratt at the Gun Owners of America on that?
Mr. Pratt has been absolutely outstanding. The Gun Owners of America, frankly, to be really honest, they make our appointments on the Hill, and they have gone with us to talk to Congress. So they've been really, really supportive. We've gotten support from so many different people. The Federal Air Marshals Association supports this bill. The Law Enforcement Alliance of America, the National Reserve Law Officers Organization, the vast majority of major airlines pilots unions, the Texas Republican Party just put this on their platform. So it's very well supported. If the listeners would like to support it, they can send an automatic letter to their personal congressman just by putting in their zip code on our site. It takes about 30 seconds. And we're at secure-skies.org.
Secure-skies.org. We've got Matt calling from Michigan. Matt, did you have a question for our guest?
Yes. Have you heard of Congressman Henry Waxman of California?
Well, have you heard of Congressman Waxman of California, Matt? How about me, David?
I have. I'm trying to think if we just spoke to him in the latest round we did on the Hill, and I'm not sure of his position on the bill. We're doing very well in the House. We need to talk to the Senate a little more. We haven't had the opportunity to talk to the Senate lately.
Well, good luck.
Whether the Congressman Waxman is on the bill yet, I just don't know.
Waxman had a list of some 270 questions that were unanswered regarding 9/11, some of which involved eyewitness accounts of near simultaneous explosions relative to the initial impact in the Twin Towers.
Well, now, do you have that?
Let me continue. The other one I'm going to highlight here, the 9/11 or the debris field of the Pennsylvania crash being some 13 miles does not match anything in recorded history for an impact that they said was a mere ground contact. And then, of course, the military jets who normally respond to these incremental FAA hijacking alerts were told to stand down. The other thing I want to bring to your...
Okay, Matt, that's really not the subject we're talking about. We're going to be covering that later this week when we have a talk on that specific subject.
Okay,
but we're talking about arming the pilots. Do you have anything on arming the pilots?
I do.
All right, fine.
There's a gentleman out of Florida who has a amazing technology known as the Myltron that was the original development and now the Black Widow. The technology involves some sort of electronic interruption of the autonomic nervous system so that the voluntary muscles involved in any kind of overt activity are interrupted, suspended most effectively without any kind of harm. I've got a video all about it.
Okay.
And the gentleman, the inventor of it, whose website I believe is myltron.org, he offered to arm all the pilots of all the airlines, etc., free of charge. Free. Absolutely free. And there's no way, and the flight attendants as well, there is no way any kind, they tested it on hardcore felons who were on drugs. And there's no way anybody can withstand the interruption of their autonomic nervous system. They fall like a wet noodle.
All right, fine. Thanks so much, Matt. Have you heard anything at all about anything of that sort? And would that be applicable to what you're doing?
I've never heard of the Black Widow. I know we looked at non-lethal weapons. We looked at the taser, and we looked at some of the other weapons that are out there that are non-lethal. And what we came up with was that we have to be able to stop a motivated team of terrorists, and we have to be able to stop them at least for, up to 6 hours. In the worst case, an airliner can be over the Pacific Ocean 6 hours from land. So when we looked at the taser, it was a single shot or a two-shot weapon. It stunned the assailant for 25 to 35 seconds. They could hold a seat cushion in front of them and defeat it. So we couldn't find a weapon out there, and I haven't heard of the Black Widow, but we couldn't find anything out there that would be useful against multiple assailants and on a permanent basis. Because if the guy gets back up 30 seconds from now, you still got the same problem you just had.
All right, so you think that a gun is certainly a very effective weapon. It has been for many years, and I think these other things would be fine, but certainly not for a situation we're in out over the Pacific or out over the Atlantic Ocean, and you've got all the lives of the passengers there. That's what you're really protecting, the lives of the passengers.
Right, and I think that's why, you don't see police officers carrying a taser unless they already have a firearm. You don't see that as their primary weapon, and I think that's true across the board. If you're it's bringing a knife to a gunfight. We believe the terrorists will be able to get weapons, any weapon they want, on board the airliner, and we think security screening proves it. The lack of security screening or the ineffectiveness of it proves it. So we have to be ready for them, and that's the reason federal air marshals don't carry tasers as their primary weapon.
I think that would be a very good analogy. If they were such a good weapon and so effective, why not give them to the air marshals, and why not take away their guns? Or we could do the same thing with the people who guard the president, but I think anybody would feel that was a rather an absurd suggestion. So anyway, of course, as we see this continued vulnerability of our planes and our commercial airliners, my understanding, and I think you alluded to it earlier, is that they're actually training our fighter planes how to shoot down commercial planes in case they're hijacked.
Right, and they're proud of this. They're going out and doing test runs and to target innocent airliners. And that, you know, we may come to that someday, but all we've said is, my gosh, don't you want a layer of security between the attempted attack of an airliner and either another 9/11 or a fighter shooting the airplane down full of innocent people? Don't, in that moment where you are a passenger and the terrorists are running up and down the aisle screaming and cutting people's throats, don't you want your pilot to be armed?
Well, I certainly would. Now, what about if they were going to shoot down the plane, wouldn't they use a heat-seeking missile and just knock out one of the engines? Would that destroy the plane, or would that just cause it to have to land?
No, it would destroy the airplane. And that's one thing we've told folks, is that, you know, that you can argue all you want, but the one weapon that will not miss is a air-to-air missile. We saw Korean Airlines Flight 7 shot down by the Soviets years ago. And that was exactly what happened. The heat-seeking missile seeks the heat from the aircraft's engine. And yet when it hits that engine, the fuel is in the wing. And the fuel goes, and then the fuel in the other wing goes, and then the airplane goes. And you've seen what happens when the fuel goes with TWA 800 over the Atlantic. It's not survivable. And so, you know, we talk to folks who say, well, what if an armed pilot shoots a flight attendant accidentally? What if someone gets killed? And we say, well, yeah, but the alternative is, of that remote likelihood, is the entire airplane exploding in a military missile's fireball and everybody on board being killed. And or the other alternative is the military doesn't get a chance to do that, and we lose 3,000 people in another World Trade Center or a dam or a bridge or whatever their nuclear power plant, whatever the target may be.
And
that
so,
just doesn't make sense.
Well, none of this really makes sense. This is what's really so disconcerting about this discussion. And yet I know that you and the other pilots are there, and you're concerned about, you know, the passengers, and you're trying to do what's right, and of course, being more or less blocked at any turn. Well, at every turn, at what point do you think that this new legislation, the Cockpit Safety Act, or Cockpit Security Act, can get out of committee? Is there any effort to block that and tie it up in committee, or do you think it's going to be able to get out before Congress recesses?
Well, we don't know. On the one hand, there's a short legislative session, and Congress has a lot on their plate right now. At the same time, we could do this so quickly. We could arm 40,000 pilots using the 5 top gun schools in the country in a matter of months, and we could really have a plausible defense on our airliners. So if Congress wants to show the American people they're engaged, if they want to show them they're not asleep at the switch, they will move this legislation out of committee, because this system is already in place. This isn't reinventing the wheel or installing an intelligence czar. It's already happening. It's already going, and all we need to do is expand and strengthen it and run it in good faith, and it would be the quickest, lowest-cost thing we could possibly do for airline security.
Now,
the fact that we've spent $12 billion on security doesn't work, and we could run this thing with roughly $100 million one time. It's just unconscionable that they're not pursuing it more aggressively
now,
than they are.
Who would do the training under under the Cockpit Security Act?
The TSA would retain the authority for primary training, although they are offered the authority under the bill to contract it out to private gun schools, much like they've contracted some of the background processing to Lockheed and some of the other agencies that are involved in the programs that are handling the screening. So they could use private firms. And there are so many great, and I'm not talking about your local gun store, there are four or five what we call Tier 1 facilities, Front Sight in Nevada and Gun Sight, Paulding, Arizona, Blackwater in Virginia. There are some really high-end facilities out there we could use that could train a bunch of pilots, and they really want to do this because they want to help out the country also.
No, I'm sure they do. I think the pilots are a very unique group. I think they're highly trained, highly motivated, and extremely intelligent, and I think most of them are, really care about their passengers. That's the thing. It's a frightening thing to have the responsibility for all those people's lives, and what a terrible thing to sacrifice a few more planes, because for one reason or another, some bureaucrats seem to have an entirely different agenda, and it doesn't include protecting the airline flyers. What do you think would happen if we were to lose another plane? Don't you think this would be just disastrous as far as the airline industry is concerned?
I think my answer would be, what airline industry?
Right.
Because you've got airliners right on the ropes right now. United, US Air, Delta is struggling to stay out of bankruptcy. Southwest is doing pretty well so far in JetBlue, some of the low-cost carriers. But what this would do, the travelers are just now starting to come back. And we're reliving the summer of 2001 right now. We are having great loads on our airplanes, lots of people traveling for the first time, and yet we're in a threat environment that is, as the 9/11 Commission says, as great or greater than September 11th was. And we know what happens next. And we don't have the time. As the commission said, we do not have the luxury of time. We've got to get these bureaucrats out of the way, and we've got to act to defend ourselves.
Well, I certainly agree with you, and I think most of our listeners out there. And again, of course, we hope that you'll go to the website. That's secure-skies.org, secure-skies.org. And apparently there's a place there you can fill out an email and send it to your congressman and senator and encourage them to get the Cockpit Security Act out of committee and get that enacted before congressmen go home for their fall vacation. That's the Cockpit Security Act. And again, the website is secure-skies.org. Well,
we're also a nonprofit organization, too, so we don't even pay our people. We work strictly on a volunteer basis. So if there's if you have any extra money lying around, you believe in the fight, we have a button that you can donate very easily also.
All right, fine. I think it's a very, very worthwhile item. In fact, the life that you save certainly could be that of your own or one of your loved ones. Well, it's about time that we let you go. But do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners this evening?
Just that we control this country, and with the proper engagement, we can tell the government how we want it to run. They really do listen when people write in, and then they call, and then they fax, and they get the impression that, boy, the Americans are really up in arms about this, and they want this done. And we can make it happen. We've just got to take the bull by the horns and decide that we're going to do it.
So the legislation is there, and all we need is enough of you out there in the listening audience to send either fax or email, or better still, go to the secure-skies.org website, and of course, send an email, and you can do that. It's a great way that they have it all there. All you have to do is go to their website and find the area where it discusses this Cockpit Security Act, and then send that email off. So they make it so simple for you. And I would know that the Gun Owners of America has been doing this for some time. They've had great results, and on various pieces of legislation, and they certainly need to have it done on this one. Well, David, thank you so very much for being with us. It's great.
Thank you so much, Dan. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, I sympathize with you. I know that many of our listeners out there must feel the same frustration that you do and that I do. But, of course, think what will happen if we have another attack. And it is because they have done everything they could to block the arming of the pilots. God bless you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, I hope that you've listened and you've asked the same question, and that would be why. Why is there a conscious, organized, orchestrated effort to block doing what is totally logical? I mean, wouldn't you feel far more comfortable knowing that the cockpit was guarded? Wouldn't you feel far more comfortable knowing that there were armed air marshals on your plane? Well, the chance that they're there is very, very small. So since they're not going to have enough money to put air marshals on every plane, the logical thing to do would be, of course, to have the pilots armed. The pilots want to be armed, but they've done everything they could to discourage it, and you have to ask why. The president could solve this with a stroke of his pen, but he refuses to do it. He tells us we're involved in a war on terrorism, and yet, of course, he refuses to do what's necessary to protect the airline passengers. And I'm sure if John Kerry was there, we'd have exactly the same situation. I'm not saying this because I want you to vote for John Kerry over George Bush. I think that we have a situation, an unfortunate situation, where we have people in positions of power who march to a different drumbeat, who respond to the sound of a different trumpet, who dream a different dream. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we need to remind our listeners out there that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. And, of course, we hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours every day. And we're on radio someplace across America 5 hours a day. We're on the Internet 5 hours a day, and you can hear our programs early in the morning at 7 o'clock Pacific time, or, of course, 10 o'clock East Coast time at AmericanNewsNet.com, and then from 3 to 5 Pacific or 6 to 8 Eastern at GCNLive.com, and then our evening program on RadioLiberty.com. We have our shortwave hookups. We have shortwave 4 hours every day. And if you don't know the various frequencies, well, you can go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. And look them up, or even give us a call here at the station. We'll get them for you. Again, our number is 1-800-544-8927. If you need to reach the station, it's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And then, of course, if you would like, of course, to get in touch with us, 1-800-544-8927. Now, we hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do. If you'd like to get a free copy of our newsletter, and certainly the May-June newsletter tells you who Osama bin Laden really was. Our July newsletter tells you what really happened on the morning of September 11th. What really took place that morning. And we hope that you'll want to get it. And, of course, we try to document everything we say, not what somebody else has said, but the material that you can find from reliable sources to tell you what really happened on the morning of September 11th. That's the July newsletter. You'll have to request it specifically. It'll probably be out, probably the end of this week or the first of next week. And we're sorry we're a little late getting them out, but I've just been snowed under with so much material. And this is such an important newsletter. As we begin to pull this whole story together, and this will be my final newsletter, we've got a number of them up there. We welcome you to go to our website at RadioLiberty.com, pull down those newsletters, and of course, copy them and get them out. We hope, of course, many of you will want to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, because you can't understand any of the illogical things going on in the world today unless you certainly understand the spiritual component of what's going on. And that's what my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, deals with, not only the political and or geopolitical and historical, but the spiritual as well. So you can get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. If you want to understand who it is who's financing the enemies of freedom, you need to get the book, Foundations, Their Power and Influence. It was written in 1958. We've kept it in print because it's one of the five most important books in my library. And everybody who's read the book has told me that they're so grateful that it is still available, and it is available through Radio Liberty by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. The book Foundations, Their Power and Influence. You can get my interview with Mr. Norman Dodd, who is the Director of Research for the Reese Committee, which investigated the Great Tax Exempt Foundations. Mr. Dodd long since died, but this is like a voice coming to you from the grave and explaining to you what this is really all about. People of great wealth who have a different vision of the world. People of the great wealth who would rule the world and, of course, create a new world order and a new world religion, because behind everything going on are the spiritual forces that energize them. So the book Foundations, Their Power and Influence, the book Brotherhood of Darkness. Let me suggest a video, either the 4-hour or the 10-hour version of either the 4 or the 10 hour version of They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. My producer said this is not my final newsletter. No, it's the final newsletter on the 911 attack, at least in the series that we started about 4 months ago. So anyway, we hope that many of you out there will give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, that you'll pray for America, you'll pray for revival, you'll pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. But hold your calls, please, for the time being. We have with us on the line Orlean Coulomb. Orlean is one of the directors of Eagle Forum here in California. And she's certainly on the cutting edge of what's going on. She, of course, goes to meetings. She gives public speeches. She is doing everything she can to awaken the American people to the very real threat that we face. Now, the average American doesn't realize there's a problem because there's a conscious effort to keep the Americans asleep. Of course, to neutralize the church, to indoctrinate our children in this idea of globalism and how wonderful it is to be a world citizen and how wonderful this great new world that is about to occur is going to be, where everybody lives in peace and happiness and there's no more wars, and they don't understand what is planned as a living hell, because we're dealing with truly evil people who have created war after war and revolution after revolution and new diseases that are decimating Africa and much of the world today. We're dealing with truly wicked people, and when they have total control of our lives, why, of course, we will cease to enjoy any of the freedoms we have today. Well, we were going to talk this evening about a book that Orlean has been reading. It's called The Planned Destruction of America, or a word similar to that. It's written by William Grigg, who's a writer for The New American. Orlean, what's the exact title of that book?
It's called America's Engineered Decline.
America's Engineered Decline. Well, that's pretty good. So why don't you tell us a little bit about it? Is there really a plan to have America decline as far as its prominence, as far as its moral status, as far as its economic situation? Why don't you give us the background of Mr. Grigg's supposition, and then, of course, we'll invite some calls from our listeners. America's Engineered Decline. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, to tell you a little bit about Mr. Grigg, I've met him on several occasions. He was educated in the liberal mindset and graduated as a journalist. I think it was from the University of Idaho, where he grew up. He got a job working for the New Republic, which is a very liberal magazine, and in doing some of the research he did for this magazine, he began to find out, you know, this stuff is really very different than what I've been taught. And little by little, he began to find out that the conservative viewpoint is really where the truth lies, and then he got a job working for the New American Magazine, where he's the senior editor, and he's an amazing researcher. He was adopted. His background, he probably is Latino, but he can, because of his dark complexion, he can pass for Arab, for Mexican, for just about any nationality, and that gets him into all sorts of places where he can do his investigative reporting. And he really is a wonderful researcher and finds out the truth of what's going on. This book that he has written has just recently come out, and he really does let us know that there is an engineered plan to bring America down to a third world level, because, you know, if you're going to form a one world government, you can't have one nation much higher in their economy and their freedoms and everything else. So America has to be brought down to the level of other countries.
In other words, what we need is equality throughout the world, except, for, of course, for the ruling class.
Exactly. And that's essentially what this book lets us know, that if all goes according to plan, there will be no more middle class. There will be a ruling class and the poor people, essentially almost like the feudal system again, because when you have the middle class, they're the ones that demand their freedoms, and they're the ones, it's the middle class of America that have tried to make our legislators and our congressmen stand by the Constitution. They're the ones that are writing the letters and speaking out at hearings. But the poor people, they're just so busy trying to exist, or they're so caught up with welfare, they don't know what's going on. And it's, so it's essentially the middle class that have preserved the freedoms of our nation, and the elitists have always wanted to wipe out the middle class, and it's, they're having such success.
All right, now, what are they doing to wipe out the middle class? What are they, in effect, doing at the present time?
Well, one of the things, one of the chapters, the first one is called The Race to the Bottom. The second one is Banishing Businesses. The amazing rules and regulations now, because of NAFTA and other trade agreements that we have, are wiping out so many of our American businesses. Our poor people are being forced to go offshore to try to exist. This is also going along with the environmental regulations as well.
Are you talking about people or businesses going offshore to exist?
People and businesses.
Okay. So I was reading the other day about some fellow who'd gone over to India to get a job in the computer field because he couldn't get one here, and he could get a job over in India and live fairly well because they're, I know it's so much cheaper living over there. So I guess some people are going offshore, and certainly we know that they're shipping our businesses intentionally to China and to India and to other countries, and we're even subsidizing them and giving them tax breaks and doing everything we can. I remember talking to a congressman who told me that we were guaranteed industries, I mean very, very powerful industries. If they'd only open up in China, we would guarantee that if their factories were nationalized, we would not only give them back all the money they lost, but two or three times what they lost. So every incentive is being given to drive our industries out of America. Now, why would we do something that foolish unintentionally?
It's not unintentionally. There's a deliberate plan to do that. You know, it's the old communist philosophy, take from those according to their abilities and give to those according to their needs.
But, of course, are you suggesting that the communists are behind this?
Socialists and communists who have been infiltrating our government, our nation, for many, many years. And this is exactly their plan, to bring us down to a third world level so that we can kind of all be on the same status as the rest of the world.
But why would, certainly all these people, you know, who are doing this aren't necessarily communists, are they?
A lot of the people, I think, are duped, thinking that this is good. Maybe some people really do believe that, well, they've been indoctrinated in our public schools to believe that America is this imperialistic country, that we are so greedy, and that the free enterprise system, which they call capitalism, really makes us so greedy. And it is because of us that other people have lost their resources and are poverty-stricken, it's because America has taken everything, which is, of course, not true at all. The reason we are such a prosperous country is because we have had a free enterprise system. We've had freedom to be able to create, and that creativity has brought us this high standard of living. The other nations that are under socialist or communist regime, they have no freedom to create. They have no freedom to do anything. Most of them do not even have the ability to own their own property. And without private ownership of property, it takes away your desire to do anything. And most of them are just kind of existing. And they try to blame that on America, the condition of the rest of the world. That's not true at all. But by bringing us down to a third world country level, that is the goal, then they can achieve all that they would like to achieve. The middle class will be wiped out, and you know, it takes a serfdom to keep these elitists in place.
But of course, if they, what you say is true, then wouldn't these elitists be destroying their base here in the United States that has allowed them to accumulate this wealth and allowed them to dominate the countries of the other world? Because whether our listeners realize it or not, we have American troops stationed in 130 nations throughout the world, and many of those nations were keeping corrupt dictators in power. Now, if we were to destroy America, to lower us to a third world level, wouldn't the elitists that you're describing be destroying the base which has allowed them to prosper and to accomplish what they've accomplished?
I think that's really the truth, but a lot of them have not thought beyond what they've been indoctrinated to believe. They are only concerned about the wealth that they themselves have, and they think by exercising control over other people they will accumulate more wealth. But it's the free enterprise system that has created the wealth of this nation, and once that is gone, we will lose our wealth. We'll lose the basis that has made us prosper.
But, of course, what you're really describing is the impoverishment of the American people. You're talking about wiping out the wealth of the middle class, wiping out their pension funds, wiping out their annuities, wiping out their bonds, their CDs, their bank accounts. What you're really doing is describing wiping out the wealth of the people.
That's the truth. And when you read this book and just the amazing facts and statistics that he has of how many companies have been forced into bankruptcy, especially our textile industry, our steel, all of our manufacturing. The goal is to essentially ruin the manufacturing and textile industries of our nation, and they're already being forced out of business or forced overseas. And little by little, that those are the people that have always been our middle class and have caused us to have this great industry, and little by little they are being forced overseas. And then even our computer industries, I've heard so many people tell me, or I've heard on radio where they have said that they've been forced to train the people coming from India or other third world countries, train them to then take over their jobs. And after a few weeks, the Americans are let go, and these Indians or Chinese are now taking over their positions, and these people have lost their jobs.
Well, I think it's really so interesting that they keep telling us that we are going, of course, the whole purpose of NAFTA and the World Trade Organization, the WTO, was to increase our position in the world. And as we simply sent the jobs in our factories overseas, there were going to be all sorts of new jobs that were going to be opening up here. And, of course, they would be new, higher-paying jobs. Why, once we, of course, went into NAFTA, we would have, 100 million people or 80 million people in Mexico to sell to, and of course we had a balance of trade surplus, but if we'd even get a trade surplus, but even get better, once we opened the borders. Well, we opened the borders, and there was a loud swishing sound of American jobs and factories moving south of the border, and instead of having a trade surplus with Mexico, now we have a trade deficit. And the same thing is true with all of the other countries that we are trading with, and we are not getting more foreign trade. We're getting far less foreign trade. And, of course, what we're exporting is our factories, What we're exporting is machinery so that other countries can set up factories. What we're doing is exporting our jobs, and they have whole towns over there in India where people simply answer the telephones. And very often when you call for support on your Hewlett-Packard computer or your Hewlett-Packard copier, which goes with your computer, why you're going to be talking to somebody named John, but they're not really, that isn't their name, their real name is Raj or something similar, and they're over in India, but they speak excellent English, they're very capable, and they will do the job that an American was doing 3 years ago for maybe a fifth of the pay, and they're glad to have it. And so what we're really talking about, Orlean, is the progressive lowering of the living standards in America. Americans are losing their jobs, and when they get new jobs, they pay a great deal less. In fact, here in California, it's estimated that if you lose your job, you get a new job, you'll get about 30% less in salary. So it appears we're already beginning to see the effects of progressively lowering living standards in America. But they can't tell the American people this is what's planned. And yet that is exactly what is planned. And there is a master plan, and you can read the master plan if you want to, and we'll tell you later how you can get it. The other side knows exactly what they're doing. They cannot let the American people know, nor can they let them know that the leaders of both the Republican and of the Democrat Party are dedicated to this concept of globalization. Would that be a fair statement?
Very much so. And this book actually quotes both Republicans and Democrats. Even Bush is very much involved in wanting the Americas to have open borders, and it was amazing when NAFTA was being presented. It was Republican leaders that were speaking out for it. Even Rush Limbaugh wanted it. But you've described it perfectly. It has had a terrible effect on us. We have lost 900,000 jobs because of NAFTA. And those jobs have been either dissolved or forced overseas. On page 61 of this book, talking about it's called Caught in the WTO Web. WTO stands for World Trade Organization. And it was GATT that set this up. It says, it's important to remember that free market rhetoric, notwithstanding the purpose of GATT, WTO, GATS, which stands for... it's a trade agreement for services.
A general agreement for tariff and trade.
It's GATT was tariff and trade, but GATS is a general agreement for tariff and services.
Okay.
And it's controlling all of our services. For even it's anything from a beautician to an attorney. Those are considered services, and we now have an international board dealing with our local services, such as a beautician. It's just incredible. But anyway, they say either GATT, WTO, GATS, NAFTA, and similar free trade pacts, the whole purpose for this is to consolidate power, not to expand prosperity.
And I think that people have to understand it is part of the process of bringing about a world government ruled by a ruling elite.
That's exactly the truth, and that was the next sentence. The real objective is to destroy national sovereignty and erect a global government, not to remove impediments to honest commerce. And so that's what they were saying, that these wonderful organizations, these wonderful treaties, would remove any impediments to free trade. And that's just the opposite. They have created all sorts of impediments. Legitimate free trade is a path to reduced government and expanded individual liberty. The globalist counterfeit being offered today is a highway to universal serfdom.
And I think that is exactly what this is about. The plan has always been to create a feudalistic system. And for anybody who really doubts that, there's a wonderful book that was written in 1966 by Professor Carol Quigley, a liberal historian and economist who taught at Harvard and at Princeton University before he went to Georgetown University, where he became the mentor for William Jefferson Clinton. And he spent 20 years studying the secret society that dominates the American political scene. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, there is a secret society. It's all described in Professor Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. I'll never forget going to the British Museum in London, where supposedly you could get any book. This, of course, was 1980. They had every book in the world. And, of course, I went to the files there. I was able to get in because I was a professor myself at that time, teaching at a medical school. And I introduced myself as Dr. Monteith, teaching at the University of the Orange Free State in South Africa. So I got into the inner files where most people would never get, and I went through the files, and there was a call card in their files for the book Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, written by Carol Quigley, but there was no number. And I took it to the desk and I said, well, I'd like to get this book out, but I noticed there's no number. And the woman looked at it and said, I've worked here for 20 years. I've never seen a call card without a number on it. I wonder why that is. Well, of course, the reason is that they didn't want anybody to read this book because it told the secret. And on page 324, it basically says what it's all about. How the central banks of the world are working together in concert to control their respective countries and, of course, to create a world feudalistic system under their control. Well, the central banks of the world are simply part and parcel of the secret societies that we write about in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. They have an agenda. And they intend to steal the wealth, to destroy the wealth of the middle class. And believe me, we are standing on the edge of a precipice right now. If the American people don't understand what's happening, most of them are going to be destroyed. And freedom as we know it will soon become simply a remembrance of things past. We're going to welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 when we get back. Our guest, Orlean Kula. Our subject, America's planned destruction. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Orlean Kula, and she's talking about a book by William Grigg entitled America's Planned Destruction. You pick up the story from there, Orlean.
Well, it is an amazing book. I was so impressed with it. It's very short. You can actually read it in one day. It's about 160 pages with some ending footnotes. One chapter that is really amazing is the descent into degeneracy, which is at the very end. You know, they are not only destroying our businesses and our industry, but they are trying to destroy the morality of our nation. And this is all part of the plan. One of the people that really came up with this plan that is really the most implemented now was Gramsci. And I'm sure you've heard of him.
Gramsci, right.
And he was this Italian communist who went over to Russia to help during the revolution and was so disgusted with what he saw there because they were forcing communism on people by killing millions of people and you know, the horrible destruction. And he spoke out against it, and, of course, he had to flee for his life. So he came back to Italy, not a changed man as far as communism went. He still believed in it, but he believed in a gradual communism where you bring down the nation, especially by destroying their morals, because when people no longer have any morals, they don't care about liberty or freedom anymore. Well, even Mussolini didn't like him, and so he put him in prison in Italy. And there in his prison cell, he began to write these letters that ended up circulating all over the world. And this is Antonio Gramsci's philosophy of how to bring communism into a nation by destroying the morality, but to do it gradually so people are not really aware. And that's essentially what the plan is now, and you can see this going on full swing in our nation today. It's so sad to see the effect that immorality has had on especially the youth of our nation. As I go into the schools, I'm a substitute teacher, and it's incredible how kids do not even know what morality means anymore. They don't know what character means. They don't even have a code of ethics to live by anymore or a compass to guide them. And I was reading an article, even though it's like 80 to 89% of our nation still say that they are Christians, only 6% of those people believe that morality is important. That's a huge contrast. And I think the main reason is that it has not been taught for a long time to the youth of our nation.
Well, of course, I think the main thing that they had to do was first to get a mention of God out of the schools, take God and prayer and the Ten Commandments, and then, of course, to teach our young people that they would determine their own set of values. Now, there's no way that a child or even a young person or even an older person can come up with a set of values that will work. Freedom is not the ability to do whatever you want to do. It's the ability to do what you should do according to God's law. And only if you follow God's law is there going to be any freedom in a society. If everybody does everything they want to, they're going to want to cheat. They're going to want to be immoral. That's why we have so much trouble with the pornography today, because man's heart is basically wicked. But what people have lost sight of is that there's an organized effort to corrupt America today. It's, and of course, it gets back to that old adage, do what thou wilt. That's the whole of the law, and that, of course, comes from Aleister Crowley.
That's right.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Orlean Kula. We're talking about a book by William Grigg entitled America's Planned Destruction. And I think that Orlean is absolutely right. There is a master plan, and that is, of course, to change the entire fabric of our society. And but where can we find it written? You can read the writings of Gramsci. You can read certainly many, many books. But it is, where can you find it laid out in one very, very short plan, where the plan is to redistribute the wealth within our nation, in other words, socialism, and then to redistribute the wealth between nations, which is exactly what globalism is all about, the transfer of wealth from the United States to the rest of the world. And of course, when you transfer wealth, it doesn't come back again. What you do is progressively lower living standards. The latest employment report, the June employment report, showed something like 31,000 or 32,000, something like, new jobs. There should have been 300,000 new jobs. We are moving rapidly into an economic contraction. If you begin reading the figures, so we certainly have a housing bubble, but that's simply because we're creating it artificially by allowing people to buy houses that they can't afford, to buy houses, you know, with nothing down, and all they have to do is simply pay part of the rent. They don't even have to pay all of the rent on the houses they're buying. I had a friend of mine who bought a house recently, and he made $25,000 by simply buying the house. It was appraised at a higher value, and so they gave him $25,000 to buy a house that he couldn't afford, and he's sitting pretty. He's simply paying the rent with the $25,000. And, of course, this is all part of a bubble, but when that bubble bursts, why, I fear that the economic system is going to come cascading down. And I personally believe it was all planned that way, because coming out of, if you ever saw that picture of Seabiscuit, then the sort of sense of hopelessness that you saw in people during the Great Depression, we are being set up for that intentionally right at the present time. The entire economy of the world is on the edge of a precipice, and out of the coming chaos, in my estimation, will come a clamor for a new world order, a new world religion, and especially since I believe that there are going to be terrorism, I believe there are going to be attacks on the United States homeland, and we can argue whether they are originating with Al-Qaeda or they're being contrived, a wag-the-dog situation, doesn't really matter. What's going to matter is going to be the effect on the American people. And when the American people have a sense of hopelessness, when they see their savings wiped out, their pensions that they've been promised aren't going to be there, the Social Security money, there's none there. It's all been spent, you know, on wars and on certainly buying support for the politicians and paying for the politicians' retirement pensions, but not for the people's pensions. I believe there's going to be tremendous disillusionment. Don't you, Orlean?
Yeah, very much so. And what the final chapter of this book is talking about, it's called The Wages of Perpetual War, just kind of what you are talking about. They're going to keep us in a constant fearful mode with either the fear of being under some terrorist attack or a constant war somewhere. It's almost like what 1984 told us about. Your enemy will be one nation one year, and then lo and behold, the next year it'll be another nation. It's but it's all part of the plan, and it is very, very scary when you realize how far they're coming in their plan. But I highly recommend this book because it's in just 150 pages. You receive the entire plan, and I know you had to read, what was it, 1,500 pages of Carol Quigley's book to find his plan. And I'm so sorry that it's no longer available. But
no, we have the book. We carry that book.
I understand you got the plates again for it, didn't you?
Well, we didn't. A friend of mine did. I shouldn't say a friend of mine did, but a man that I knew got them. First of all, the pirate published the book, and then he gave the place to a man named Mr. Morrison, and Mr. Morrison then published the book until he retired. He had two sets of plates. One was for Foundations, Their Power and Influence, which he gave to me. The other were the plates for Tragedy and Hope, and History of the World in Our Time, when he gave to a friend of mine who actually publishes it, makes it available, and we distribute it. His name is George Gaybrick, at GNC Publications. But we carry Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, a wonderful book, but 1,342 pages, whereas Bill Grigg's book is short, concise, to the point, and easy to read. And right at the present time, if you're going to give somebody a book, don't give them a 1,342-page book. Give them something short like this, or like my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. But I think Bill Grigg has done a great job, America's Planned Destruction.
Actually,
could it be true?
Actually, it's the title again is America's Engineered Decline.
America's Engineered Decline. Okay.
It probably would have been easier with your title for it.
No, I think America's Engineered Decline. Will be back here in just a moment with Arlene. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and our guest this evening is Arlene Kula. The book is America's Engineered Decline, and I've got my copy sitting in upstairs in the library. I didn't bring it down with me. I should have. But, you know, I think that this subject is really so important that people understand that what's happening is not by accident, but it is by intent. And I think it's so difficult for people to really believe that or to accept it, and yet, of course, this is exactly what's happening. Remember what the first FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, said. You know, if it happens in politics, if not an accident, it was planned that way. And that's exactly what's going on today. They know exactly what they're doing. The war over in the Middle East was planned long before the 9/11 attack. And if you doubt that, you need to read the book written by Paul O'Neill. It's called The Price of Loyalty, and Mr. O'Neill was the Secretary of the Treasury, and he attended the secret meetings, the cabinet meetings, back in January and February of 2001, that's 7 or 8 months before the 9/11 attack. And what were they talking about? Were they talking about Social Security, or were they talking about the national debt, or were they talking about education? No, they were talking about the war in Iraq that was coming, and how they were going to divide up the oil, and how they were going to get into the war and justify a preemptive attack on Iraq. It's all there in the book. In fact, we quote that in one of my newsletters, I think earlier this year, or at the end of last year. You need to understand it was all planned ahead of time. And now they're planning on a war with Iran. How do I know it? Well, you go to Frank Gaffney's website, read his material. Frank Gaffney's part of the Project for the New American Century Group. And today I was reading his website, all the articles he has. I think there were three of them telling us how terrible Iran was, and how Iran was helping Al-Qaeda, and how Iran was helping the rebels over in Iraq, and how Iran was a threat because they were developing nuclear weapons. And I'm not suggesting any of those things are not true. I think Iran's government is a terrible government, but everybody's forgotten. 1979. The Shah of Iran was toppled by the American CIA, and we brought the Ayatollah Khomeini to power. Everybody's forgotten that. Why would we do something that foolish? Destroy an ally and replace him with an enemy? Well, of course, it's one of the best enemies money could buy. And now, of course, here we are, 25 years later. It's almost time for a war with Iran, isn't it? After all, they're a threat to America. They have nuclear weapons. They probably have chemical and biological weapons. Not only that, but... Well, what you don't know is they started training hijackers to seize our planes back in the mid-1980s. If you doubt that, you need to read Joseph Badansky's book. Get his book. It was published in 1993. I think it's called Attack America and the West. Attack America and the West, 1993, Joseph Badansky. And, of course, that was written 8 years after they began training hijackers. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Orlene Kula, and we're talking about William Gregg's book, America's
Engineered
Destruction. America's Engineered Destruction. So you pick up the story from there, Orlene.
Okay. One of the other chapters that I think is so important, in fact, it's mentioned several places in the book, is the FTAA. And this is something that hardly anyone is even aware of. Nobody is talking about it. It stands for the Free Trade Area of the Americas. And that is going to be the next expansion of NAFTA. They want NAFTA to now include all of the Americas. So we will have a free trade agreement with all of South America, Central America, Canada, Mexico, the United States. And this is going to be voted on next November, and yet hardly any newspaper, no one has talked about it. Have you heard anything about it, Dr. Stan?
Yes, well, of course, remember, I read a lot of the same publications you do, so I'm well acquainted with the FTAA. But what this really is this whole idea of, first of all, uniting the whole of the Western Hemisphere by tearing down trade barriers, number one. And then, of course, having a common currency will be the next thing. They're not telling you that this is going to have a common currency. And then when you have a common currency, you end up with a common government.
And that's exactly what's happening in Europe.
Right.
They've set the example for us. And my husband is from Germany, and he is so upset with what Germany is like now when he goes back to visit. It's not the same Germany at all, but that's the plan that we will then someday have once we form the trade agreement, just like the Europeans have the common market. Then we will eventually have the same currency for all of the Americas, just as you have mentioned, and then eventually we will have a presiding government over all of the Americas. Once we get all of the Americas united and all of the Europeans are united, it's so much easier to then form a one-world government.
Right, of course, they're going to do the same thing over in Asia. But they cannot tell the American people, so they have to lie to them. Because if the American people understood that this is a plan, an organized, orchestrated plan to destroy the sovereignty of our nation, to destroy our freedoms, and with that, the constitutional guarantees that has made us the envy of the entire world, then, of course, the American people would rise up in righteous indignation. So they're lying. And the leaders of both political parties are involved in this, and that is what's really so incredible. And this is what Professor Quigley was talking about many years ago. And he was talking about how there's this little group that controlled both political parties, and they had a plan. And it involved creating a world government under a ruling elite, and these were people, very sophisticated people, of great wealth and great power, who had this dream, which he supports fully. And that is, we need a ruling aristocracy, because us common folks, and he referred to us as the petty bourgeois who supported Barry Goldwater. The petty bourgeois don't want to go along with this, they don't know what's good for them, but the elite do. And that's really what it's all about. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And this whole process is coming down the railway line like a thundering steamer, and the average American can't even see it. But it will become very apparent, I think, next year as we begin to see the implosion of our economic system. We just begin to see certainly more and more people out of jobs then looking to government to solve our problems.
I have been helping to gather signatures to try to stop the FTAA, and it's interesting when we try to gather people to sign the petition against it. Everyone that I've spoken to who will stop and speak are opposed to NAFTA, and when they understand that this is an expansion of NAFTA, all of them say, NAFTA's been devastating for our country. Well, you can imagine how much more devastating that will be when we have all of the Americas united in a free trade agreement. But one wonderful, courageous man is Tom Tancredo, and he's been speaking out against it. And he's also one who's really been speaking out against all of the illegal immigration coming into our borders. This is what he says in the book. He gives the introduction to William Norman Gregg's book. He says, there are people in the Bush administration and in Mexico and in Congress who believe that we should do away with borders entirely. Their ultimate goal is to create this hemispheric free trade area, consolidating all of North and South America into some kind of United States of the Americas. And he says, we are undergoing a radical change in our national character and social structure, and it shouldn't be allowed to happen without, at very least, the informed consent of the people. But nobody knows about this. I'm among those who believe that it shouldn't be allowed to happen, period, and I believe that this remains a majority view, which is probably why it's being done by stealth and misdirection. And that's essentially what this is all about. They got probably too much flack when they opened NAFTA up for discussion, so they're doing this one without any discussion at all.
Well, I think it's amazing, Orlene, how they've been able to suppress information on the FTAA from the average American. If this is a major issue, why don't we read about it? And why doesn't Rush Limbaugh or Bill O'Reilly or Dan Rather or Tom Brokaw talk about it? And it's because they're not supposed to, because you're not supposed to know. Your attention's supposed to be focused on the war over there and the battles in Fallujah and the battles against this radical Islamic cleric, and on the casualties and... But you're not to understand that while our boys are going overseas fighting the wicked terrorists, why we're losing our freedom here at home, exactly as happened during the Vietnam, when the greatest transfer of power from the states to the federal government took over, and they introduced the welfare state and socialism in America, and of course they took God and prayer out of our schools in 1966 during the early years of the Vietnam War, and they found a woman had a right to have abortion in 1973, and they used Vietnam and the horror of that war of course, to change America. And this is one of the major reasons for what's going on over in Iraq today. It's a wonderful distraction, so we don't understand what's happening here to our economy, to our sovereignty, to our nation.
That's very true. This evening, just before I returned home for your broadcast, I belong to a Toastmasters club, and I was there, and I helped one of the new members prepare a talk about the FTAA, and she did a wonderful job. She has a beautiful singing voice, and she started her talk off by singing God Bless America, but changed the words to the Americas, and where it says, from the da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Anyway, she says, from the palm trees to the Gulf of Mexico, from Alaska to Tierra del Fuego, God bless the Americas. My home, sweet home, God bless the Americas, my home, sweet home. And boy, did that wake up the audience. and that's what it's going to be. We will no longer be a sovereign nation. We can no longer have the wonderful liberties that we've had all these many years in this beautiful nation. And most, we'll lose our economy, we'll have economic devastation. We'll lose our local and our state and our national government. We'll lose our sovereignty. We'll lose our borders, and hardly anyone knows anything about it. And this is supposed to be voted on next January. It's just incredible.
All right, fine. Well, we got to go to Matt calling from Michigan here. Mike, did you have a question or comment?
Yes, comments and a question. Chambers of Commerce have apparently endorsed GATT, NAFTA, and all the other trade agreements. And, of course, they somehow duped the unions to go along with it, including UAW and AFL-CIO. And then those involved, like this guy Donahue and others, were elevated to high positions. And NGO organizations, it's a systematic smoke and mirrors. There is this free speech TV. I gave up cable a year and a half ago and unknowingly getting the free speech TV. They've done a whole series of programs on the Free Trade of the Americas Agreement.
Are they for or against it?
Oh, there's no question they're against it. They pretty much present the Marxist socialist fascism for what it is. And I can only equate democracy as that now, Marxist socialist or private corporate fascism.
All right.
Now, in this man's book, I recall an article, now actually a book called Report from Iron Mountain, and ultimately the author was a Schlesinger, I'm not sure which one, but they detailed a blueprint in this where they were actually coming out and stating that this is what's going to happen. There's going to be unilateral disarmament, and they even said in the prologue that lasting peace would never be in the best interest of democracy. And they said even if it could be attained, it would not be in the best interest of democracy. So now I'm wondering if this gentleman proposes any solutions to this this incredible problem. And let me just qualify that by stating that a few years ago there was a series of C-SPAN broadcasts regarding funding for the United Nations, and ultimately culminating in proposals for greater taxation. And as I understand it now, from various impeccable resources, that the whole tax system is fraud and extortion. And just to tweak the interest a little bit, one can go into the local library and look up the noun United States as it's defined in Black's Law Dictionary, and you will see that as of 1999, the seventh current edition of Black's, the term United States is deleted. Prior to that, there was always three separate distinctly different definitions for United States. So, as I understand it from various resources, the United States has ceased to exist legally as a municipal corporation, a sovereign autonomous municipal corporation. And in fact, ever since the Bretton Woods Agreements of 28 and 45, it's been under foreign ownership. And I suppose that's why they have always referred to the greatest natural resource here in America being the young children, because in fact it is the bodies of the young children through the birth certificate that has collateralized the bankruptcy through these foreign bankster organizations.
Well, we're getting pretty far away from the subject here. Do you have anything specifically you'd like to comment? Well, let's get Orlene's comment. Do you have anything you'd like to comment on what the... let Orlene speak, please.
There is a very good chapter in here, What Can We Do? And we can't give up. We must continue to have hope. And he mentions, you know, how we need to organize and be with other like-minded people and standing up for what we believe in. And they do have a website called www.stoptheftaa.org where you can download a petition. And we've been going out in front of Safeway for several weeks now and gathering signatures. And you know, just if we can do that in communities across the nation, by the time January comes, enough Americans will have woken up to really start fighting this. We're not going to hear about it in the national media unless we get it on public radio ourselves or talk shows, whatever we can do.
Well, that's why we're having you on tonight. Thanks very much, Matt. Let's go to Jeannie, who's calling. Jeannie, do you have a question or comment?
Hi, Dr. Stan. It's nice to hear Orlene this evening. She sure is a dedicated woman.
She certainly is.
Yeah. I might want to bring it back to home about the Chamber of Commerce, and this is kind of interesting. In Santa Cruz County, California, a couple years ago, we had a man come in from Albuquerque, New Mexico. And these are all facts. So this was Mike Schmidt that came into Santa Cruz County, and he became CEO of the Chamber of Commerce. And before he left, after 2 years, the board of directors actually voted in a core value of that Chamber of Commerce, which was to have sustainable businesses in Santa Cruz County. And it's interesting, Watsonville, which is a city, farming city, just south of Santa Cruz County in California, they now have a man that came from Carson City, Nevada, and he's of the same ilk. And what they do, they come in for a couple of years, and they create this core value regarding sustainable businesses, and then they move on. This guy that was in Santa Cruz County, CEO of Chamber of Commerce, he is now in Tracy, California, which is a farming community, and I'm sure he's pushing sustainable communities. So here we have carpetbaggers coming in and being here for 2 years, and then they move on and do their same old dirty work in other towns.
Well, I think that it's important for our listeners to understand that this whole idea of sustainable development is simply a socialist scheme by which the government regulates every aspect of human endeavor. And where we move away from elected officials to appointed officials and the bureaucracy and NGOs running society. Would that be a fair statement, Jeannie?
Yes, and it goes even deeper because in these sustainable communities, what the Chamber of Commerce will do is they will actually say what type of business can be in that community. And so there it goes very, very deep of not having free enterprise, but a board, actually a board telling the community what business you can have and what products you can buy. So it actually regulates totally our life.
And, of course, this is what communism is all about. People have to understand that communism and socialism, stripped of all their idealism, is simply an authoritarian system by which non-elected officials regulate and control the populace. And whether you call it communism or socialism or fascism or Nazism, it's all the same. It's a ruling oligarchy. And that has been a long-term plan that has been around for literally thousands of years. All was working towards the New World Order, the New World Religion, but it is coming to its culmination in our lifetime. We live in one of the most exciting times in recorded history, don't you think, Jeannie?
I think so. And, Orlene, thanks so much for being on this evening.
Thank you, Jeannie. I would just like to comment about this whole idea of the planned economy that you mentioned. Here in Santa Rosa, where I live, I think we've been one of the pilot cities to bring what they call career pathways into the schools. And going along with the planned economy, a board figures out what economy they're going to have for your county, and then the schools have to go along with that. So maybe the school will only offer four careers or five, and the students coming in the eighth grade have to choose one of those career pathways. Some board of directors that the governor has appointed will determine, for example, here in Sonoma County, some of the pathways are agriculture, tourism, culinary arts, but nothing. There's no attorney, there's no pre-med course, and so it's a very dumbed-down economy. And then the curriculum is planned accordingly so that the student will only get so much English that someone would need if they're going to become a chef. So much history, so much math, so much science, and I call it, instead of the three R's, I call it the four L's, limited learning for lifelong labor.
And that's really what it's all about. In fact, if you heard Governor Schwarzenegger's recent remarks, he was talking about this idea of centralizing all power for education with the state government and then beginning to train citizens in cooperation with the corporations so that we could train people for corporate jobs. And, of course, this is what it's really all about. It is fascism that's being set up. It's no accident that before Arnold Schwarzenegger was allowed to run for governor. He was taken to England to meet Lord Rothschild, and we have this wonderful picture. In fact, it was at the meeting I was at recently about a 4x4, and there's Arnold Schwarzenegger and Warren Buffett and Lord Rothschild all smiling at one another. And of course, I think they're sort of laughing because the American people really don't understand what's happening. We have a ruling oligarchy. They have a different agenda. They march to a different drumbeat. They dream a different dream. Maureen, why don't you sort of wrap up your thoughts for this evening? And I really want to thank you so very much for being with us. And of course, we'll be talking again on some of our other programs about this this whole concept of America's this planned or this engineered destruction.
That's right. Well, I just would like to thank you so much for having me on and for your wealth of knowledge. I learn so much every time I'm on your program just from all the things you are telling us. And I think you are truly one of the greatest Americans. I'm so glad that we have a Dr. Stan out there. The great knowledge and information that you impart to all of us is wonderful. Well, I highly recommend this book, and I don't even know where you can... Do you carry it yet, Dr. Stan?
Well, we can certainly get it if any of our listeners want to get it. I don't know. How much is it? Do you have any
idea? It's $5.95.
Okay, fine. Well, of course, do you have a website where people could go to get that? Or?
I'm just looking right now. It's... they can... Yes, it's America's Engineered Decline. You can get it by ordering online 1-800-JBS-USA1.
That's 1-800-JBS-1.
USA1.
Okay, fine. Thank you so very much. I appreciate so much for being with us. And it'll be interesting talking about it. I think we have a program here later this week.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Good night. God bless.
Good night.
Okay, fine. Well, that was Arlene Cullen, and she does a wonderful job of course, getting the information out across America. And she's out there gathering petitions and talking about the free trade zone of the Americas and the free trade association of the Americas. And the fact you haven't heard of the FTAA simply reflects how important it is, and you're not to know until this is a fait accompli. Little by little, they take our freedom. They know exactly what they're doing. Now, the master plan is more or less laid out in something called the Earth Charter. It was written by that great American hero, Mikhail Gorbachev, and then, of course, Marie Strong, who's a multi-billionaire, whose wife is a witch, and they have a 200,000-acre little plot up there in Colorado called La Boca Grande, where the occultists from all over the world go, and at least according to the article of West Magazine we have, there's Henry Kissinger and of course, Robert Strange McNamara. You'll remember Robert. He was the one who sent our boys to fight and bleed and suffer and die in Vietnam, but never to be allowed to win. And, of course, Marie Strong and Robert Strange McNamara and Barbara Mark Zucker were all on the Board of Advisors of the World Future Society. Their logo was a circle with three sixes in it. Till we began talking about it, they changed the logo because it was just so obvious what this is about, and it was about organized evil. But Mikhail Gorbachev has written a new Ten Commandments along with Marie Strong and Stephen Rockefeller, the son of Nelson Rockefeller. And the Rockefellers have been involved in the occult for generations because this is an intergenerational movement. If you'd like to get a free copy of the Earth Charter, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. Point 10 talks about the redistribution of wealth within nations and redistribution of wealth between nations. That's what globalization is all about. Redistribution of your wealth and the destruction of your future and of your children's future. And now, of course, you really need to get our sustainable development syllabus. You need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or the Brotherhood of Darkness Special. The book Foundations, Their Power and Influence, which will give you an overview of how the great tax-exempt foundations created by the great fortunes of Rockefeller and Carnegie and Ford are being used to finance communism and socialism. Not that these people were communists or socialists. They were beyond that. They understood that these are really systems of centralizing power in the hands of a ruling elite. And when you understand that, then it all begins to make sense. And it goes back to Plato's idea laid out in the Republic of a ruling oligarchy, a massive military and police force aimed at, of course, controlling the populace. Maybe they were even going to protect them from the terrorists. You can't tell. But anyway, that is what Plato advocates in his book, The Republic. And then, of course, everybody else into serfdom. And that is exactly the direction we're heading now. So remember, again, the books we're talking about, the Brotherhood of Darkness, Foundations, their power and influence. We even actually carry that book that Matt referred to. It's called The Report from Iron Mountain. It was written by a man named Carl Lewin. We carried it. We think it's an important book. It's also covered in Joan Vian's book, The Global Straitjacket, where I think that she goes into the background of the report from Iron Mountain. It's all a master plan. But if you get our sustainable development syllabus of why it contains the Earth Charter, we hope that you'll want to do that. Of course, we'll be glad to send you one free of charge, just simply the Earth Charter, if you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, and then we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival. We ask, because if America doesn't turn back to God, is there any reason why God should ever bless this country again? We ask you to pray for our leaders and ministers, but please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927 if you want a free copy of the Earth Charter. And then, well, until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you.